Welcome to Time to Talk Science and Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. I'm Dr. Charlie Highmarch, and I'm an assistant professor and researcher at Queen's University.
And I'm Stephen Archer. I'm a cardiologist, researcher, and director of the Translational Institute of Medicine, which we affectionately refer to as TIME.
Every guest brings with them a dangerous idea, an idea that, if proven true, could change how we understand disease, shift the direction of research, or transform patient care. But science isn't just about data and discoveries. We also want to meet the person behind the science. What drives them? What inspires them? And what keeps them curious? To date, we've showcased the work from more than 20 scientists from a wide spectrum of disciplines. We've explored neutrinos with a Nobel laureate, discussed often overlooked impact of bleeding disorders in women, and discussed the challenges and successes of primary care in Canada with medical educators and a former dean. Now is the time to talk science and medicine.
Today, we're fortunate to have Dr. John Muscadari in the studio. John is an intensivist at KGH, Kingston General Hospital, and full professor at Queen's University. He's also the research director for the critical care program and an expert in, oddly, geriatric medicine, which is not the first thing you think of when you think of critical care. He's a director of a new institute here at Queen's University that's focused on healthy aging, which we'll be talking about today, and that's called AgeWise. So Dr. Muscadari, thank you for coming into our show today. Before we get too deep into our work, however, I'd like to get your origin story. How did you wind up becoming a critical care doctor? If you rewind back to your childhood, was this in the cards from the beginning, or how did this happy result occur?
So thank you so much for inviting me to be on this. This is great, and happy to talk about my origin story. So just winding things back. So we're a family that immigrated to Canada from Italy. Growing up, I didn't have any inklings that I wanted to be a physician. There was an expectation that we would go to school. I was the first one to attend university. So I chose Western, University of Western Ontario at that time, just out of a lark because I liked the name. I wound up in residence, and my roommate wanted to get into dentistry, but his dad was a physician. And so we started to talk about it, and that's what gave me the idea that maybe medicine was something I wanted to do. My second year, I applied, which I was fortunate enough to get in. I'd originally gone to university thinking I was going to do physics and astrophysics because I was interested in space travel. And the fortunate thing about that is that when I got my medical school interview, we spent 45 minutes talking about the space shuttle and space travel with the two interviewers. And that was the whole gist of my interview. And because of that, and I was able to get into medical school. Then going on after that, I was interested in knowing as much as possible about the human body, and getting back to my hard science background, I was interested in data, and acute care provided that the most. And it was critical care that that actually had the richest physiological data that you could act on, that you could get. During my training, how I got into research was that during my last 6 months of training, there was a mandatory research block, and I was fortunate enough to be assigned to spend it in a basic science lab. So what I looked at was lung injury from ventilator-induced lung injury in rats, and I learned to do tracheostomies in rats. And over 6 months, I was really fortunate. The research went really well, led to a paper which was then published, and it's my most cited paper to date with almost 2,000 citations.
Now, it's interesting because in an intensive care unit, you've got all these people who are on ventilators, and not every single person, but most people are. And this paper you did, I think you were working with Dr. Slutsky, you mentioned, who's a pioneer in this field, and you were showing that if you kept pressure on at the end of the breath, that's called positive end expiratory pressure, or PEEP, that was beneficial. And is that true in humans as well as in rats?
That is exactly true. And so I just taught a session on mechanical ventilation last week. And the point is that you need to ventilate people in the golden spot, not with pressures not too low and not too high, right in that very
Goldilocks center. Sort of.
Goldilocks area of mechanical ventilation.
I think that's such a cool translation of showing how you can go from an animal model and actually influence patient care. So that must have been quite a kind of transformative way of you getting into research. Have you continued that kind of research through your career, or have you kind of moved away from?
So that's a great question. So I've always been interested in lung injury and participated in a lot of clinical trials studying different lung ventilation strategies. So that's where it is. But I didn't continue on with the basic science. I didn't have a really formal basic science laboratory training. It just was fortunate that I was able to ventilate rats with and do tracheostomies on rats, which was a bit of a learning curve.
Yes, and tracheostomies are a little, if you want to just describe that for our non-tracheostomy crew audience.
Yes, so tracheostomies are holes in the windpipe that bypasses the vocal cords. So they're done in the windpipe and you attach the ventilator directly there. As you can imagine, rats have very little trachea, so it's a bit of a technical challenge to do them.
And although animal research is sensitive, is a nice illustration that although everything that happens in an animal doesn't automatically happen in a person, there are lots of lessons we can learn about people, like they need PEEP for their ventilators from animals. And as long as we treat them ethically, I think people would argue that value proposition of compassionate animal care to learn lessons to treat people is valuable.
That is so correct. And it does not take a huge number of animals, and you really have to think through what exactly you're going to do and what you're going to learn from those animals that unfortunately you have to sacrifice.
So what was the impact of the mentorship that you've received over the years throughout your training?
So the mentorship when I was training got me interested in research, but the biggest mentorship that I got was through the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group, which is a group of intensivists which meets three times a year in really nice areas of the country. But all they do is talk science, and you bring ideas there and they're explored, and you have access to some of the world leaders in critical care. So your idea may get shot down, maybe transformed into something you didn't even think about. But it's that collegiality, and it's a group think to actually improve care and improve research.
Just before we leave your origin story, there's something about doctors in space. I do know some doctors that are not interested in outer space, but your issue of space travel and astrophysics reminded me like what percentage of doctors like Star Trek or Star Wars or any kind of like otherworldly thing. So are you a fan of those types of shows, or were you actually interested in real travel in space?
That's a great question.
Hey, Star Trek is real space travel.
Based loosely on reality.
I've maintained a lifelong fascination with space travel, anything with space, with astrophysics. I was incredibly interested in this extraterrestrial life initially, and that's been, so that's a different area to get into. But I think there's so much interest. Physiology is different, and I think that's where the potential is for the human species going forward.
We'll have to see if we can get Mr. Musk, Queen's graduate, to come and tell us about space travel.
maybe not. So on this show, as I alluded to in the introduction, we like to talk about your dangerous idea, which is kind of us asking how your idea is going to be highly disruptive. What's your dangerous idea?
So dangerous idea is this, that we can alter the process of aging. And we can alter the process of aging such that, not that we're talking about increasing lifespan incredibly, but we're talking about what's called the increasing health span, which is the amount of time that you actually spent in good health throughout your life. And if we're able to do that, we're actually going to be able to increase the amount of time that people spend in good health, spending with maintained quality of life, which I think most people Most people are, that's a, something that most people value. But that the reason that's dangerous is because it will mean changing how we think about aging. And aging too much is up to now is there's almost a derogatory aspect to aging. We see aging as something that's inevitable, that you're going to be a burden to society, and that needs to change.
So essentially, you're shortening the gap between lifespan and health span, which presumably already exists, and you're kind of like shortening that so that those two spans meet each other.
Absolutely. So the my ideal way of aging would be to reach a certain point with maintained function, maintain quality of life, and then pass away quickly. That's how I think what you want to do. And so by altering through geroscience, which is the science studying the process of aging, the central hypothesis is that by changing the biological process of aging, we can prevent chronic disease, not treat disease as a one-off that we currently do.
So it is interesting. Several things you said are interesting. I was recently getting my hair cut, and the person asked me whether I would want the seniors discount, and I'm like, I am a senior, but no, I don't want the discount because I'm annoyed at being asked that. Yes. And so it is interesting that there's sort of a pejorative thing about aging, and yet aging is success. To survive is to be successful, and you're trying to enhance that success. So how would you take geroscience? That's G-E-R-O science.
Yep. Yes.
How would you take geroscience, and what does that mean for our listeners? Like what kind of stuff are you advocating? Is this going in and manipulating someone's telomeres so they live longer, or is this more practical in the here and now?
Well, so geroscience, there's a couple of aspects of the geroscience. One is the application of currently known processes, currently known evidence that can change the biology of aging. And those are encompassed in what's called the AVOID framework, which is maintenance of activity, vaccination, optimization of medications, staying socially connected, reducing social isolation, diet and nutrition. And those are critically important to age well. But then the science, the geroscience has come a long ways in the past 50 years. We understand the process of aging much better, and we can actually start to think about how we intervene with some of the pathophysiological processes that occur with age. So, for example, reduction of the inflammation that occurs with age, which is associated with worse outcomes, some of the biological processes in the mitochondria, which provides energy to the organism. And trials are starting. So the last I looked, there were about 30 to 40 trials in clinicaltrials.gov that were studying some of these interventions. The maintenance of muscle mass is another good one that a lot of people, as they go older, lose muscle mass, which really impacts on their function.
It is interesting because you can take the same phenomena and look at it from a basic science perspective, and it sounds very Star Wars-ish, like we're going to fix your mitochondria, we're going to lengthen your telomeres, we're going to reduce your oxidant stress. But the way that might be triggered could be something very mundane, like getting vaccinated, eating a healthy diet, exercising regularly, which oddly enough changes those same parameters that sound like you should be taking some very fancy pill. So in this network here, this institute that you founded at Queen's, is that focused more on the how to do things in the here and now, or is it more forward looking in terms of molecular medicines, or is it some mixture of both?
That's a great point. I think the worst thing that we could do in this space is to say that here's a pill for you, lead a bad lifestyle, and you're going to do well. I think the message has to be
that's not the answer we wanted, John.
Something a bit easier. That would be great.
We have to re-record that.
Okay, so can you tell us about your latest discovery or your program? We talked about your institute and AgeWise. Maybe you can just unpack that a little bit and tell our listeners what the scope and goals of that are.
Well, so with I'll just tell you about a trial that we just finished in Adelaide, Australia, which looked at the application of these healthy aging behaviors facilitated by a web-based platform. And actually looking at, in the trial, although it was a smaller trial, people were randomized to either usual care or behavior change to adopt those healthy aging behaviors. The people that were randomized to the group that adopted the healthy aging behaviors, their progression of frailty was actually much less than the other group. This was a shorter term study, but we can actually measure progression of frailty over a period of time. And so if you do that, it will reduce your level of frailty. And then getting back to my formal point, and then if we adapt those, and then maybe you could think about what pharmaceutical intervention or pharmacological intervention you want to do on top of that.
Okay, I'm just going to stop and just go back and define the term frail and frailty and what you mean by frailty. And we had quite an interesting discussion ahead of this about what that might mean in the context and connotations. So maybe unpack that a little.
Yes. So most people don't like the term frail because it connotates a weakness looking at some of the literature, that it's the fault of the individual. Whereas, from a medical point of view, frailty is the loss of physiological reserve, and you're much more susceptible to stressors. So for example, a cold or urinary tract infection in a 90-year-old who's frail may have catastrophic consequences, versus a 90-year-old who's not frail, they may be able to get over it, treat it, and they get back to normal.
But the thing that's kind of interesting about that is that frailty can occur at young ages. So I think when listeners hear it, they might think of this as something that only applies to people in their 80s and 90s. But there are certainly patients that I see in cardiology clinic that are frail and that are 50 or 60. When I think of like trying to explain frailty to people, we talked about this yesterday. I love the Mr. Burns in The Simpsons, who's the definition of frail. So he has to get Smithers to do all his physical activities for him.
Yes.
But can you comment on the relationship between age and frailty?
Yes. So the incidence of frailty rises with age. But aging and frailty are not synonymous. And frailty gets to the point of biological versus chronological age. So at about the age of 65, about a quarter of the people, about 20%, 20-25% over the age of 65 are frail. When you go to the age of 85, about 50% are frail. But if you look at the flip side, 50% are not frail mm-hmm. at that age.
Yes.
And maybe frailty is maybe not a good way to look at things. The WHO, World Health Organization, has started to adopt the intrinsic capacity or the maintenance of what you as an organism or as an individual, your capacities as you grow older, as the flip side of aging. So maintenance instead of preventing frailty, we're looking at maintenance of your functional capacity as you get older.
And do you have a sense? There was a movement a few years ago to start talking about exercise as a prescription. So when I talk to cardiac patients, I'm usually saying, I want you to exercise 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week, and these are the kinds of exercise you might consider. So that's kind of a prescription. And amazing to me, it actually does work. In many cases, people come back and report what they've done. If you were to apply all the things you mentioned, vaccination, healthy diet, lack of social isolation, and that list, do you have any sense for the dose effect of this intervention you're prescribing? Like, can someone get 2 more years without frailty or 6 months? Or I'm sure it varies, but is there some sense of how much cumulative benefit I might accrue if I adopted these interventions?
That is a great question because there isn't a clear answer to that because these interventions have not been adopted in totality. So you can look in the literature. There's a huge amount of literature as to the benefits of exercise as you grow older. There's benefits to vaccination. There's benefits if you look at optimization of medications, being on the right medications for the life state. But they really haven't been applied together in a population-based way and with behavior change strategy. So you can apply them, but unless you actually motivate people, have behavior change strategies behind them. And maybe a prescription is one way to motivate people, but there's other ways to motivate people. There's a huge science behind behavior change. And I think that's, so they have to be adopted in totality plus with behavior change.
Well, that's a really nice segue to my next question, yeah. Rich, really is, you know, when we're thinking about lifestyle, the one thing I kind of know about going to the gym, it's all about consistency. So the longer and more consistent that you are, the more likely you are to reach your goals and surpass them. So I'm going to take you to the other end of the spectrum. Yeah. And I live with three boys who are high school age, my sons. And aging is about as far from their mind as it possibly could be, and rightly so. But if you were to tell my children or any high school child what they should be doing to prepare for aging now, what would you say to them?
So yeah, that's and I think that gets to the point where aging starts at birth, and the more you actually intervene earlier on, the better it is. But speaking to a high school student, and I think we talked about the analogy of a car. So as you get older, as a car gets older or any piece of equipment, it needs to be maintained, and you maintain by changing the oil, by changing the tires, by doing all those things.
Literally, they call it preventative maintenance, which is where you're going.
That's right. Preventive maintenance. So that's what when we're talking about activity vaccination. So that's the preventative part. But then the geroscience part would be that maybe you could apply some new technology to that car so that it doesn't rust. And so you have the prevention, which is going to help to keep the car on the road. But as you go along, maybe you can improve its interaction with the environment so that some of the irreversible things that that may happen to the car as it gets older, it may happen to you as you get older, don't happen.
And it's interesting in your Adelaide study, and I don't know if this applies to high school students or not, but the point you sort of made just in passing was that it was an intervention. It wasn't just, I'm going to tell you, you need to do X, Y, and Z behaviors. There was some kind of prompting or coaching that went on through an application to teach these people what to do and try to get them motivated and engaged. Is that right?
Yes.
Because we had Chris Booth on here from oncology, one of our cancer specialists, and he had a big paper, which I'm sure you saw in the New England Journal, showing that lifestyle intervention of exercise after colon cancer was prolonging people's survival. But he made a big point during the podcast about how it wasn't just, say, go exercise. It was an actual program. And he was actually advocating that the health providers here in Canada, OHIP, the people that pay the bills in Ontario, should actually pay for exercise programs and counselors, because in the long run, it would save them money because people would do it more. They'd adhere to these healthy lifestyles and they would live longer. I don't know is that what you envision for geriatrics, like that more personal coach, or do you see a computer solution like used in Adelaide?
Actually, it's probably both. I think we used a computer-based process in Adelaide where people could track their frailty level over time, have education about the importance of things, and for example, nutrition, all that, have modules that they could take online. But I think health coaches would be really important as we go older. And there's also literature on health coaches with aging to actually improve behaviors. So it may be a mix. For some people, it may be just a virtual type of coach. For some people, they like a connection. But if we're really going to invest in keeping our population aging well or healthy aging, it would be both things. And having the availability of those things as you go older would be really important. And actually, I think would be a quite a good investment on the part of society.
So you're an incredibly well-published and respected scientist in your field, and you've got all these networks that you're involved with, and you're leading an institute at Queen's, but I'm sure there have been some bumps in the road. Every time we have someone on the podcast, we talk to them about when things have not gone well and what have they done with those lemons. So have you, by any chance, John, had some bumps in the road?
Did you make lemonade?
That's right. If not, get off the podcast. We're only interested in success.
Yeah, so absolutely. You cannot have a career and not have bumps in the road. I think the biggest bump in the road that I encountered was when I finished my critical care training, had some wanted to do some research. But at that time, there was the perception on the part of government that there were too many physicians and they were in the act of cutting back positions. So there were no research or academic positions in Canada. And I was offered the opportunity to go to the States, but I wanted to get out to work. So I went to a community center. And actually, that was a big bump at the time. But I think it actually, looking back, the lemonade was great because I think I became a better clinician. It got me interested in doing randomized controlled trials because that's how I was able to stay engaged in research in the community. But I started being a site for some of these larger multi-center trials. And after about 10 years or 11 years of in the community, there were positions because of the government cutbacks. There was a position at Queen's and I was recruited to come to Queen's and I was able to continue to research here.
That's amazing. When it comes to the practice of medicine, it really is the practice of medicine doing medicine. There's a saying that I love, which is that in theory, there's no difference between practice and theory, but in practice, there is. So there's something about actually going out into the world and doing medicine that really does inform you and make you a better doctor. But that's a great response, and God bless the government for deciding there were too many doctors in Canada, too many nurses, and too many hospital beds, which is something we're still struggling with in Kingston as our hospital is literally overflowing, a consequence of poor planning for many years by the government about the actual bed occupancy that would be required in an aging society. And John, I don't know if you know this for our hospital at KGH, but do you have a sense of what percentage of people either in critical care or in the hospital in general would be frail? Because my impression is it must be pretty significant just from what I see walking around.
Yes. So frailty is quite common in acutely ill patients. Most of the medicine people are frail. I don't have exact numbers, but in critical care, about 30% of the people over the age of 50 are frail, and their 6-month mortality is around 50%.
Wow. That's pretty substantial. If you consider frailty as a disease or condition, that would be a pretty significant condition to have.
Absolutely. And I think we've underappreciated the impact of frailty and aging on acute care and especially in critical care. And we're seeing so much more of people that are reaching the end of their natural life that get referred for critical care services. And I don't think we're providing any benefit to them.
So we are aging at 1 minute per minute moving through life. So the next question is actually related to a crystal ball. If I could give you the time crystal ball, what's research going to look like for aging and healthy aging in, say, the next 10 years?
So I think if everything went well, we would be much more cognizant that we can alter aging going forward by the application of currently known evidence. But then there'll also be large-scale, multi-center, randomized control studies studying the biology of that look to impact on improving the biology of aging and the prevention of chronic disease.
I wish I actually hadn't asked 10 years. I wish I'd asked some, maybe 30 years, because that's a bit more relevant.
We'd all be in space.
Well, let's hope so. Okay, so before we wrap up the podcast, I would like to for our audience to get to know a little bit about you. So we've got some fun questions prepared, which usually go down quite well. So the first one is, what's your favorite meal, and can you cook that dish yourself?
So my favorite meal is pizza. By far. And I'm not talking about pizza. I'm talking about wood-fired thin crust pizza. Actually, I'm such a fan. I actually built my own wood-fired pizza oven. Oh. And yes, I can. Yes, I can make the crust. I make the pizzas. And it's actually a skill to actually cook a pizza in a wood-fired pizza
Oh, okay. So we're pretty aligned. So for about the last 10 years, almost every single Saturday, I wake up first thing in the morning and I make my dough for that night, and I pull the dough and I'm quite good at spinning it, and I'm quite good at, and I don't have the pizza oven. So maybe that's where we need to talk moving forward, because I think that's the limiting factor. My dough's pretty good, but I don't kind of get that quick rise and that crispiness and that chew.
So do you go Italian style, very thin crust?
Absolutely.
None of this Western nonsense.
Oh,
okay. No. I just wanted to clarify that for our listeners at home so they're not shocked.
Please, no.
Okay. So what kind of music do you like, John? Can you give us an example of it? Do you play any yourself?
That's a regret that I don't play any musical instruments. But I grew up in the 70s and 80s, a fan of alternative and big fan of actually punk over the years. And I've still been an alternative. That's what I listen to most often.
Do you like Green Day and groups like that?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that's punk, but yeah, is that punk?
Yeah,
I think it's punk. Which
maybe old school Sex Pistols. Maybe we go back.
The Sex Pistols, The Clash, yeah. The Susie and the Banshees. Oh. It's that sort of thing. But I have SiriusXM and I listen to the New Wave channel.
Cool. Well, I'm glad I got at least... almost right.
Yeah. Okay. So what is the strangest job that you've ever done?
Strangest job. The strangest job would probably be a security guard at a construction site, and not that that's strange by itself, but I was so bored. Nothing ever happened. So I actually figured out how to make boomerangs out of plywood by filing them with a brick. And I used to throw those boomerangs. And I got really good. They used to come back incredibly. But one time I threw it and it just came and it just barely missed this huge plate glass window. So I stopped doing that at work. But
I think you're set up for prison with those kind of carving skills. So if you could travel through time, would you travel forward or travel backward, and why?
Oh, that's a great question. I would love to go back to the Renaissance and meet some of the people that were, you know, Leonardo da Vinci and all those type of people, true. But I'd be really interested in what the future holds, although I think it's going to be more dystopian than what we...
It's going great so far as I can tell. So maybe going back to the Renaissance, you should stick with that.
Don't check the news. Don't check the news. It's fine. It's going well.
The grand finale question.
So the grand finale question is, if you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
Oh, that's a good... A great question. A cartoon character. I don't know. I was a big fan of Bugs Bunny growing over the years because he could get away with almost anything. Like, he was Teflon, and nothing would ever happen to him. So maybe Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, well, that resonates with me.
Love Bugs Bunny. Yeah. Yeah,
everyone's favorite. Dr. Muscadere, on behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, we'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to our audience and to us today in the studio. And to our listeners, we'd like to thank you for taking time to get to know Dr. Muscadere with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you did enjoy this episode and would like to know more about research at Queen's University, or indeed share this podcast, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here, and thank you for the conversation. It's been great.
Thanks, John.